Mr. Cheeseman, reel 16. You were discussing, or you were talking about the new barracoon blocks that you were in.
Yes. Well, I was posted to the headquarters, the battalion headquarters, and when I got to my new barrack room, I found that in that barrack room were the orderly room, the battalion orderly room clerk, very handy for a little bit of gin before anyone else got on. We had the technical officer storm, the technical stores storeman. We had the quartermaster's storeman. We had the carpenter. We had the butcher. We had two cooks and lorry drives, because I was in transport section. Well, so what? Well, just think of this. There was two cooks. There was always someone on early term, i.e. they had to get them. By the way, the cooking arrangement, it was very good, the cookhouse there, brand new, but it was all coal fired. So he got a pretty backstage. But anyway, when they would get up to light the fires very, very early, the duty cook, light the fires and what have you, and of course, what does a cook do first of all? Make himself a mug of tea. Well, our cook used to make himself a bucket of tea. And so we woke up every morning to a hot mug of tea. There was that song during the war, the sergeant major with a cup of tea in the morning. We had that, honestly. Right, we had the quartermaster stores chap. Well, when your blankets got threadbare, you'll change it for new ones. And you'd hand in your old blankets, which would be destroyed, actually. But knowing the storm in there, so you can have them back. So we had bedside rugs. Old blankets, in other words. I mentioned the carpenter. We had bedside tables. And when we went on manoeuvres, we had camp beds. I'm talking about Butlin's holiday camping, aren't I? As compared with the disciplines that we had in our basic training. I think it would be about the middle of 1937, the following year, when we began to get steel wardrobes in as an issue for keeping our civilian clothes. Rather than a suitcase under the bed. We also got the new type of bed, which was spring-loaded. We still had the same three old biscuits we had, but they were quite comfortable. We never had any, there was no curtains up in the windows, by the way. And I must tell you this, the orderly officer, when he's coming round each morning, each Saturday morning, on his inspection, of course, would just look to see whether there was any dust anywhere, what have you, and woe betide you if there was, And I may have given you the picture that anything goes, but no, there was a certain standard of honest to goodness, civilised discipline about the place.
And did you have your full kit out on a Saturday morning?
No. Never had.
It wasn't the traditional kit inspection.
All the time I was there at Ferngrove, I never had a kit inspection as such. But, as I say, the only if you come around the courses, the only sergeant not on his heels was all ready to say, excuse me, sir, you haven't looked at this sort of thing. Well, now, why I continue to be a source of the blue-eyed boy to the technical officer was that all my life, right up to now, I have always been keen on model engineering. And I mean model engineering, not making toys. And naturally, I would wanted to make a medium tank inch scale. And I mentioned this to the technical officer, and he was all for it. He helped me to draw the drawings and give me the drawings, what have you. And I started building this model tank, this 12 1 inch equals 20, 1 inch in the model, because a foot in the actual thing. And the model slowly built. I was allowed to use the workshops and what have you. The model slowly built, and it was always on my bedside table. And all the officers, they always made a beeline to see how far it got on each week. And the orderly themselves used to say, by God, he said, never ever finish that model. Never finish it. Just keep it there. Is because all that happens is they come into the barrack room and they make a beeline for it. And I'm like, oh, yes, look at the tiny rivets and little nuts. Oh, and this works and that works. And there. And then he's so enthralled, he forgets about the rest of the barrack room and he goes back out again. And of course, I used to get a bit of a lashing from the orderly sergeant. Get rid of that tank thing. Next Saturday morning, yes, Sergeant. And of course, I conveniently forget, knowing that he didn't put the blue eye, the lovely blue eyed boy on a charge. So, by and large, you had a very, very happy time in the tent.
Cleaning the rooms, was that still on the traditional style? Oh, did you have rotors and so forth?
Yes, yeah. Your own bed space had it cleaned, and then you would, toilets and what have you. Yes. They were very, very a stickler for cleanliness. Cleanliness was, I wouldn't dream of saying polish the bottoms of your boots and what have you, and burnish your boot studs. But by jingles, you never did get to that, but it was a question of cleaning the toilets with your toothbrushes. It was very, very strict on that score. For instance, when we mounted, it was a prowler guard at that time. It was mounted at 6 o'clock and came off 6 o'clock the following morning. And it was only a prowler guard. I'll show you the photograph of that. But it was best serge, putties, webbing, and a swagger cane. Now.
And what did that prowler guard do? What was his duty?
Going around the barracks and the tanks, the tank hangers and what have you.
You didn't have a full guard on the gate, or?
Oh, no. Now, when we were mounting guard, proper guard drill, and smart, of course, we had to be smart in that, and we were inspected. I have been on parade there with tarnished buttons. Just an odd eyebrow lift, that's all. But I didn't go on there on guard with an unclean vest underneath, because that on guard is a very unused tunic to see if clean. That's the sort of thing. Cleanliness. But, and smartness, but as regards the finer details.
And you didn't have a stick man on the guard, did you? The smartest one on who basically became the runner and messenger. Nothing like that.
No.
So your course came to an end, your radio course, wireless course. What happened to you then?
As regards this course, this was in the school block, brand new, where when it's raining and what have you, you've got the driver mechanic classes going in one end and the driver operators in the other end. Ordinary schoolroom, as you'd expect, and something like that, but attached to each of these was a place where you put a lorry or a tank in so that you could work in the tank. But at the end of the first individual training period, which actually took you right up to manoeuvres from 1937, I had passed the preliminary test, theory-wise and what have you, of my DO course, and got very good marks. Again, again, you see, that was a fellow in the Capital Guards, the Tally Technique. Then I went on manoeuvres with the Austin 7, but whilst I was on manoeuvres, there were occasions when wireless was required, and that's where I did my practical part of the course. I would go on about, as a tank crew member, I would go on about 5 or 6 manoeuvres. The first, put it this way, out of the 3 months manoeuvres, I'll probably do 6 weeks as a tank crew member, and the rest I just jump back onto the Austin 7 again. Then, when that 1937 I'm talking about, when that finished, I went back to school, and then it was the higher part, and by Christmas I finished and got my one or three day extra.
And the 6 weeks, we're talking about really now the 1937 manoeuvres, the 6 weeks that you were in the tank, what were you doing there, driving and operating?
Oh yes.
Combined at the same time.
You see, my classification was DO, driver, operator, spare tank driver, operator. You see, in battle, if a gunner is killed or is wounded, there's other two gunners that can take all from him. But what if the driver's killed? So there's got to be a driver. We had to drop in, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, so that's why we had driver operators. You see, a driver mechanic, per se, there wasn't many there. Well, there were plenty of them around, but not many that was paid. It was then that I realised that WT wasn't very popular with any of the tank commanders. They didn't like it at all. And you'll appreciate the fact that with no suppression on any of the equipment, we had an awful lot of what they call these days white noise, but it was really crackles and stuff. And you really, you had to get attuned to understanding the spoken word, which the tank commander didn't get attuned. After all, you've got other things to do besides that. And so Morse code came in more and more for transporting messages, which is long and cumbersome. But then, if the tank is in direct vision, why not use the flag signals? Because everyone knew the system. And so I would say during that 1937 half maneuver period, I can honestly say that wireless was used probably 40% of communications, and the rest was by flag. We were still in the infancy of the world. Also, of course, by then they were beginning to get different wavelengths. You'll appreciate the fact that if I'm using a wavelength, you can't use it, otherwise everything jams. So, and that was the case when I first sort of was introduced to wireless. Only the one wavelength of all brigade. But I don't believe that for one moment. They must have had more than one wavelength, but that's what we were told, so that's it. But there was certainly more than one wavelength. However, it wasn't a question of going to your wireless set and saying, right, you are, go over to wavelength B. Your wireless set was set for one wavelength and no other. If you wanted, in those days, if you wanted a different wavelength, you took the wireless set up and put another one in.
And how did that work in practice then? You know, with tanks moving and you've got to keep contact with your section, your company, your headquarters, and so on.
Put it this way, by today's standard, it didn't work. But by the standard that was then, it was miraculous. He was a tank that was out of sight of another tank, and he'd say, I want help, please. There's a heavy concentration of enemy on my left flank. And this tank would come, he'd hear, and, you know, this was, of course, Morse code.
This was Morse code, not voice.
Mostly Morse code, yes. And we wireless operators learned our own shorthand this business.
I think we've mentioned this actually, your own shorthand. Yes. So essentially the problem with voice was that making yourself understood with all the background noises.
That's correct. Well,
so it must have been very easy not to pick up the right order if it was of your own voice.
Well, and the question is then, repeat last message, you know, and of course if you're on that wavelength, say we would be number three section of A company, and your company commander sends an order, repeat that section, and somebody in C company B section is waiting to come on here and kind of come on here because you're repeating or what have you.
And how was the Morse code side work? Because you would be sending out possibly a Morse code message and someone else in another tank would be sending one. Was there a clash there?
Oh, no. No matter whether it was voice or Morse code, it was one
tank at a time.
Yes, one tank at a time.
So did you have to give way to seniority on who wanted to use the line?
It's not a question of that. You see, if I'm Private Cheeseman, never did that because we're having a private conversation with Simon Blom about what picture we should go to see this weekend and like that. It doesn't matter if Brigadier Hobart himself would want to come. He couldn't get on to say, "Get off the air, you lot," you know.
Just like
he would listen in and say hello, we take his name.
Yes, no one could get in until the person using it got off. Did that cause problems in action, I'm thinking of particularly? Someone has an urgent message and someone's on.
Please understand that when I'm talking about maneuvers, you know, they were fixed. It was like playing, taking part in a scripted act. But after all, what you have to realise, it was an absolutely brand new method of conducting the war. And, it was magnificent at the time. Absolutely horrible by today's standard, but it was, you know. It was, of course, by 1938, and I've come to that, I'd left all this behind me, but by then, the number nine set was on the go, which, again, if I remember rightly, the number nine set, it was only able to transmit on one wavelength only. However, the BBC or the powers that be had allocated bigger wavebands for this sort of thing, and so we could use. For example, we take A Company, three sections. Their A Company headquarters would be on waveband A, and he could transmit an exchange message between his three sections. B Company would be on wavelength B, and so on like that. And incidentally, you say, well, what about then getting headquarters of A in conjunction with headquarters of B? Well, everyone had sort of, in conjunction with headquarters of the battalion, who had two connection tags, you see. You'd say, look, I want a message sending to B headquarters, and he would shout over to the tank and the message would go. Also, of course, six-wheeled sort of stack Can you know what the old Al Capone cars were like? You know, with the canvas roof. Well, that's what these Morris commercial staff cars were like, but with six wheels rather than four wheels. Now, they would have there, especially the main the chap who's judging with umpire, the main umpire, he would have two, even three receivers. All the so he'd get messages all together. Step by step was getting him through. And when the number 11 set came along, you could swap around, you know. And this is all before the war started, by the way.
What was the significance in the numbers? Number 9, number 11, whatever. Was it something to do with...
Well, what's the significance of the MBM seat?
There wasn't any, no.
I should imagine that the prototype of this new idea of a tri-prototype, you say, oh, that's great, but this particular, we've got a problem here. Oh, well, do away with that, we'll start with number 2. Mm. And so like, when they got the number 9...
That's how they came to it, yes, right.
I should think that's what it'd be.
Yeah.
In fact, it actually did develop to... I think it was Alamein when I first saw it. You got the walkie-talkie, which was quite a large thing, and you also could, an infantry chap could plug into the tank and speak to the tank command. I mean, the rate of improvement in communications, wireless, was faster than I'm talking at the moment. It was really leaps and bounds. Simply, I suppose, not only because of the advancement of technology, but also because more and more people in the corridors of power were beginning to say, hey, there's something in this after all. Yes, come on. And more people got onto the bandwagon, as it were.
Did the 1937 manoeuvres follow the same pattern as the 36?
Yes.
Over the same ground?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I always remember one point where sometime really would always congregate there was point, remember, can I? 693, that's right. It's the same B class where I used to live, the road B693, but there's a spot out 693. And I've often wondered since whether on Salisbury Plain now they're still congregated at spot out 693. Oh, yes, it was. Well, let's be so crude. You know? I mean, we can laugh at the crudeness of it, thing, but. It was a lesson which we were doing wrong and wrong again, so we learned it off by heart, as it were, you know. Which the Germans it picked up the cello and learned it quickly, and we did.
And the tanks that were still the same? Mm-hmm. There was no improvement or changes there?
1922 medium tanks. I'm being a bit... The Mark 1 was 1922-23. The Mark 1 medium tank. I think the Mark II, which was the majority of tanks when it was there, I think they're late 1920s or even early 1930s. But there wasn't so many of them, you know. And the 1st Tank Brigade, I'll say it. The 1st Tank Brigade was the entire British Army's amount of tanks. Why I hesitated there was because I'm forgetting about the 4th Battalion, which was stationed up at Catterick, and they were an infantry battalion. But as I say, the 2nd, 3rd, 4th and 5th Battalion, that was the battalion RTC in England, home-based. They had the entire British Army amount of tanks. We had 2 tank transporters, 2!
Now, these tanks that you were using then and manoeuvring with then, what qualities did they have as fighting vehicles?
Well, let's go back to the First World War. The old landships, they got a sponson on each side with a gun which could travel so far, 30 degrees or something, no more. Look at the blind side. The medium tank, 1922 Mark I, was the very first tank in the entire world that had a medium gun that caused 360 degrees in the turret. So you see, it was a huge step forward.
This was a three-pounder gun, was it?
Three-pounders. And also, of course, it was a semi-automatic quick fire. That was only referring to the shell. You didn't, you know, in the artillery those days, you put the shell up the base, and then you put the charge up, and then you put the firing cap. Well, all this was, it was just like a huge .303 rifle shell.
But, you know, it was all compound in the one.
So that was the quick action, and the semi-automatic was that it wasn't a question of you putting it in and shooting the breech. You slammed it in and kept your hands out of the way, and the breech closed. The reason you kept your hands out of the way is because of when that breech closed, if the gunner had the trigger pulled, like it would fire. And if your hands were in the way, the recoil, you'd smash your arms up. A modern factory inspector would condemn it. Talking of that, by the way, steering a tank, what you actually did was that you broke the drive to the particular track and then put a brake on the track, right? And this was done through what they used to call the Rackham steering clutch on the medium tank. Now, that's perfectly okay when you're going across country. It doesn't matter if you're one side or the other. And with your tracks, if they weren't exactly the same across the stretches, if they weren't exactly the same, you'd go around the circles. But it really didn't matter because you can let the tank wander and then give it one bump and you're back on course again. But on a road where you have to follow the little deviations, so it wasn't a question of putting your brake on enough, it was a question of slipping your brakes. You know what happens for order when you're going with a heavy load going down an awful long hill. And we used to get, as normal procedure, we used to get fires in tanks. These for orders, they're going on the road. The whole gunner, on manoeuvres, he just made up a number because you couldn't fire him. So that was his job, was putting the fire up with the firing. Can I tell you a joke about that, by the way? These firing fire extinguishers, you know, the old fucking brass ones, you pump, you know, which had, I forget the name of it, the chemical and as we all know now that if you smoke but have vapour coming up, the vapour going through the lighter cigarette, it changes into deadly poison. But we didn't know that at the time, so forget about that. Right, when you're coming back from an exercise, especially being on a road exercise, one of the duties of one of the of a couple of crews was refilling these pyrene extinguishers, because there was about six of them on the back door of the tank, and they'll be empty and I'd fill them up again. So, and I was helping the holder of the fill up one day, sitting away from the tank. We weren't allowed to smoke it in the tank. Sitting away from the tank, and we were filling these up, and we were smoking, of course. And the sergeant major came along. He stopped horrified, you know, as if he was horrified. Hell's bells, lads, is smoking whilst you're filling pyrene. Do you want to blow yourselves up? You'll be a mass of flames, I think. And we said, oh, sorry, sir, we didn't realise. And we carefully dumped. And then we walked away and he looked over his shoulder. And we were pyrene, we were not petrol. What, that's a joke.